Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
This whole finger quote school year, you were at home and kind of on your own, really going through what is unschooling for the first time.
Yes.
Right? Were there any new challenges in that that you discovered?
Yeah, I would just say, like I said in the beginning, there was just this, you know, my sister and I had definitely grown apart, as well as the four of us, my mom, my dad, my sister, and myself, while I was at school, because we were spending so much time away from home. And, you know, when we were at school, my sister and I rarely talked to each other. You know, we sort of had our own little friend groups, if you will. But when we came home, it was like we really struggled to get along. If I'm honest, for the first few weeks, we weren't listening to each other. We didn't know what the other person was struggling with or what they needed to hear or the sort of support that they needed. But eventually, as we got back into it, we really sort of discovered our love for at-home learning again. And we really started to listen to one another and interact with each other. And if somebody was having a hard day or they were perhaps being a little more slow than the rest of us, then we would learn to put our arms around their shoulder and work at their pace and take the struggles with the joy in them.
When I see the connection, though I see I don't stare, though I see I don't stare. When I'm lost in my reflection, though I see I don't stare, though I see I don't stare.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is June 13th, and I'm recording this monologue while driving in a car. And I might be a little long-winded as a result of that. You know how it is when just a man in a car, open road in front of him, and wonders to himself, where am I going? Am I going the right way? And yes, my GPS says yes, I am. But sometimes I'm in the car for a while and I just start talking to myself. And I have recording equipment right next to me, and I know I have to do a monologue. It would probably be a healthier activity to make all this talk useful. So that's what I'm doing. Very excited to welcome for the first time to School Sucks today, Noah Tetzner. Noah is 17 years old. He has a very interesting educational history. We're going to get into that in some detail on the show. And Noah is also the host of a pretty successful podcast, even though it is brand spanking new. It's just a couple months old. It's called The History of Vikings. You can learn more at thehistoryofvikings.com. Noah is a School Sucks listener. And just to tease his story a little bit, he left private school last year and embraced unschooling. You're going to hear all about it on the show today. You know, we do quite a bit of Viking talk in this one. I find it to be a fascinating subject from a historiography point of view, the study of the study of history. And you know, we didn't talk about the berserkers. Oh, do you not know about the berserkers? They were a very entertaining group of Norse raiders who would decorate themselves and almost go into a trance-like state before battle. If I use the word entertaining, the people who encountered them would not have described it that way as entertainment. It was not for them. But we talked a lot about some of the myths, not Norse mythology, which we do talk about in great detail as well, but the historical myths around the Vikings. And I'm actually wondering how much of the perception of brutality is generated by encounters with these berserkers. It's an interesting question. But I wanted to have Noah on to talk about his school experience, his education experience, and to cheer him on in his new endeavor, which is podcasting. I mean, podcasting is fun. I do it and I love it. And just before we get the conversation started, I want to let you guys know I'm about to start making my way to the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest in Delton, Michigan. I kept saying the Detroit area. Turns out it's nowhere near Detroit. I think it's like 2 hours away from Detroit, to the west. in the middle of the state of Michigan. I'm going to be there Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. And I sincerely hope to see you there. I really mean that, you know? I mean, get up right now and go look at yourself in a mirror. Look yourself in the eyes. I wish that was me right now, having that experience with you. I'm just kidding. I don't even know who you are. And the truth is, you should never go anywhere because some stranger from the internet says, I want to see you somewhere. Definitely, especially if you're younger, kids, don't make that a policy. But you should go for yourself if it's convenient. I know this is a little bit short notice. You know, when I was on my trip last year, last October, and I swung through the Detroit area and met a whole bunch of these folks that are going to be at this event, I was really sad that I could only stay for one night. I think I was there for less than 24 hours, and I had a really, really terrific time. It is an amazing group of people, and I am super excited that I get to spend 5 or 6 days getting to know them better. And if you're there, you can watch me do that. Also, coming up this October is the Contra Cruise. I am a featured speaker along with Tom Woods, Bob Murphy, and Jeff Dice from the Mises Institute. And that's a cruise. And if you come to that, I promise I will get off the ship at every port of call in full berserker garb and just terrorize the locals there. And if you're with me, we can make some fun Instagram videos. The other thing about the berserkers is I think they were, when these raids took place, they were in altered mental states. Some of the research suggests they were using magic mushrooms. So, you know, you bring the mushrooms and I'll take it from there. So those are two things coming up, one in a week, one in October. If you want to learn more about the Contra Cruise, you can go to ContraCruise.com. And yeah, that's it for today. Let's get right into my conversation with Noah. Towards the end of it, we get into, you know, the future of his podcast. Like, where does Noah want this show to go? I try to, in addition to my encouragement, share some of the lessons that I've learned along the way. And if you're interested in that subject, I highly recommend you check out Season 1, Episode 1 of The Mastermind, which is now available on Patreon and in the AV Club. It is Richard Grove, Kevin Cole, and myself discussing the past, present, and future of our media projects in great detail. Appreciate the positive feedback I've gotten about that show so far. And if you are a School Sucks supporter, I would love your input on future topics for Mastermind shows. By the way, if you're new, if you don't know this, the Mastermind is a weekly supporter-only roundtable show. And I like how it's going so far. All right, everybody, that's it for today. Here is my conversation with Noah Tetzner. His thoughts on school, on his own self-directed education, his love of history, his interest in the Norsemen, and the future of his media project. It's all coming up on the show today. Thanks for listening, and here we go. Noah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brett.
First of all, congratulations. At 17 years old, you are the youngest guest of the year so far, and you're bringing quite an impressive story with you today, so I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for having me, first of all. You know, your show has been such an inspiration for me personally, and I know that the success that I've had, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later, could only have happened because of the work that people like you do, the inspiration that you guys provide. So I'm a huge fan of the show, and it's honestly just a real treat to be able to have this conversation with you today.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you saying that. And because you are a teenager interested in self-directed education, how did you hear about us?
Yeah. So when I left school 6 months ago, I was new to unschooling. I had heard about, I'd been familiar with unschooling I'd been familiar with homeschooling because I had been homeschooled before I went to private school. But, you know, upon leaving, my mom really just brought up this whole thing that is unschooling. You know, she discovered John Holt and lots of unschooling books and all sorts of videos and articles. And she was like, Noah, look at this. This is so cool. And of course, I was hooked from the beginning, you know, because I'm all about, you know, sort of individualism. And I love that kind of stuff. But I found your show because I listened to podcasts. And right away, I was, you know, there's got to be some not necessarily even unschooling podcasts, but podcasts that really view learning in this way. And I came upon your show, you know, the School Sucks Project, and I was like, oh, dude, that's awesome. Like, and I was already familiar with some of your contemporaries, you know, Tom Woods and all those cool guys. So I was immediately hooked, man. And I was like, oh, so yeah. So that's
awesome.
I heard about you guys.
All right, so I want to talk to you about your schooling and your education, something that I've been thinking about, and it was a subject of some debate and discussion. I went on a tour at the end of last year, and on the very first day of that tour across the country and back, somebody said to me, radio host, you know, Free Talk Live, you know that show?
Yeah.
All right, Mark Edge, I was on with him, and he said to me, if a person had to attend school for a third of school, you know, like the first 4 years, the middle 4 years, or the last 4 years, what would you pick? And I said, I don't know. I think the last four would be the safest. It's when a person's probably most interested in school as a kind of social scene. You know, high school is kind of like a, you know, a nightclub for teenagers, that kind of a thing. But I wouldn't want for a kid to start there and, you know, have that be so present in one's formative years. You started as a homeschooler and then went to private school for a few years and then left before graduating. So I just want to hear your story about what was it like to be homeschooled? Why was that decision made? And then why did you decide to actually enter a school when you reached high school age?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently 17 years old. I am just finishing up my junior year, and I had been homeschooled from first to eighth grade. It was beautiful. It was great. We had tried, you know, all different sorts of things with homeschooling, you know, all different sorts of curriculums, co-ops. We were very engaged in the homeschool community, and it was beautiful. But when I was coming upon my freshman year, ninth grade, my parents sort of had this idea to send me to a local private school here in Wisconsin where I live. And I guess I would really have to have this conversation with them as to why that decision was made. I think it's because, you know, so many unschooling and homeschooling parents feel like, well, I can't teach my kids. I don't know, you know, science, math. I'm not smart enough. And perhaps, perhaps they were feeling those same feelings that so many parents do. And you know, at first I was a little reluctant, but then I just sort of went along with it. I was like, oh, you know, I'll try it. I could be fun. Or, you know, it could be fun. Could be interesting to meet other people and that whole thing. And I went in, and you know, my first year at private school wasn't horrible. It was okay, you know, sort of just going through the motions. There was some good days, there was some bad days. But then my second year going to private school was just, it was not fun for me. You know, I had greatly matured. I had really started to establish sort of my own beliefs, my own opinions, what I thought was right. And I had really, just like so many other teenagers, started to develop my own goals and my own dreams, you know, that I really wanted to chase after. And I just came to this epiphany of, it was like, I'm spending 8 hours a day learning what other people would have me learn, you know. The things that they're teaching me are not things that I find practical for my personal life. These are not things that I'm going to be using in my future, in my career, in my everyday life. This is stupid, essentially. And as I was getting older, the school that I was going to, private school, was what they called an academically rigorous school, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It was getting harder. I was like, you know, why am I doing this?
So more of your mental energy is being sucked away from the things that you want to do. You're in 10th grade. You're what, 15 years old?
Yep.
And yeah, I certainly understand that so much of your bandwidth is getting eaten up by, academic rigor, right? Probably a lot of homework, a lot of attention has to go into school itself. what were you envisioning for yourself that you weren't able to do at that point? At that point in your life, it was like a year and a half ago, right? But what were you thinking you wanted to do? What was school holding you back from? What was this vision that you had?
You know, I've always, well, I suppose at the time, to back up a little bit, at the time I had really been interested in real estate, actually, which now that's not as much my thing, but at the time I was super interested into it. My dad owns his own small business, a real estate appraiser. My uncle is a realtor, and I had been actually doing an apprenticeship with him, and I had started that while I was in school, and I was like, you know, we were making all these big plans for me to go work with him and him for really to take me under his wing, you know, and there was just absolutely no time to do any of this, much less, you know, more of the things that I was deeply passionate about, history and Vikings and that whole thing. But yeah, that's basically what it was holding me back from, I would say, is just my passions, my desires. And
what was attracting you to the world of real estate? I'm interested.
Well, I've always been super interested into business, you know, capitalism, how money works, you know, that sort of that whole sphere. And I suppose that stems from my interest in history, because I was always deeply fascinated with, you know, John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and the great titans of the Industrial Revolution. I really saw that in real estate. You know, people were constantly doing deals. It was a very social business. And the firm that my uncle was working for was very successful. My uncle was making a substantial amount of money for one person, as was my dad with his small business. So I really saw a huge opportunity in that.
Now, you talk about the negatives of the private school experience. Were there any positives? Were there anything like, you know, 9th, 10th grade, you get there and you say, oh, this is great. This is something that I've been missing, even if it wasn't necessarily academic?
Right. You know, for me, it was, you know, I was exposed to a lot of things there academically that I wasn't a fan of course. But there were, I will say that.
But just like boredom, or you disagreed with the things you like disagreed with?
Yeah, both, I would say. I would say that probably more strongly the second.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the subjects were boring, but other ones I just thought it was pointless as to why they were teaching us this, you know, especially spending so much time on these things. And then, you know, the teachers get mad at you when you ask questions like, where am I ever going to use this in my life? And it sounds like such a renegade teenager thing to say, but if you really look at it more deeply, it's so true for a lot of those subjects. And, you know, I could go into the specifics and details, but.
Well, it's kind of like a curriculum in your time isn't valuable, right? Or your mind isn't valuable. Your ability to make decisions needs to be constantly questioned at that age. And it's really not the truth. And obviously, if you know a little bit about the history school of school, this has just been, you know, extended and extended and extended throughout the 20th century, where people are effectively adults in their like mid to late 20s now, you know, because people are lingering in one form of school or another, or one form of schooled mindset, maybe even longer than that, into their 30s. So, yeah, it has a real impact, and it sounded like you had an understanding that your time was valuable and you wanted to direct that time and energy into things you found meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you have to have a conversation, a difficult conversation, with your parents about leaving school at that point, or were they good to go? Your mom was very pro-unschooling.
Yes.
Was that difficult in any way to transition out?
You know, I'm thankful that it wasn't, in the sense where it couldn't have happened more naturally, because I have a sister who is a few years younger than me, and they actually took her out of school. So I left in October of this past year, 2017, and my sister actually started the 2017 school year at home. My parents had taken her out before then, just simply because it was similar situation to that of my own. So, you know, I was like, well, you know, my sister's not doing school, and my parents actually sort of egged me on a little bit, like, Noah, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we could, you know, homeschool again? And I said,
sure.
Absolutely. So, you know.
And you're familiar with the term de-schooling, right?
Absolutely.
Did you feel like, I mean, even though you had 8 years of being home educated, Did you feel like there was any de-schooling process that was necessary for you from having been in that structure of school for a pretty solid, like, 3 years?
Yeah, I would say there was some definite de-schooling that went down, meaning that, you know, my sister and I had been had been homeschooled for 8 years before we went off to private school. But I think once you become part of a school, it just becomes such a part of your life. It becomes, you know, the center of your social world. Even after school, you know, all the school families are doing things together and everything like that. But, you know, once we left, it's almost like we had forgotten how to homeschool, if that sounds, you know, even remotely.
Sure.
Like, yeah. But it's like we had forgotten how to homeschool, and we came home, and there was just some de-schooling that needed to happen. And my mom was actually familiar with that at the time. And she said, you know, Noah, you can, I was not to over-dramatize it, but, you know, traumatized or something like that. As my sister was, you know, she had been carrying some self-esteem issues that had arisen because of school. But I, you know, my sister just needed this time to essentially just exhale and take a break, right? And we were still learning at the time, right? Because learning never stops. But we were just doing it in a very relaxed, in a really relaxed way those initial weeks that we were out of school. And it's almost like, holy cow, like, we're out of school now. Because you go from that deep lifestyle of being part of this institution to, you know, coming back home and learning to understand each other and learning to listen again and learning to hear everyone's needs, which there's no time to do when you're shipping the kids off to school for 8 hours a day.
Really well said. So you've been back at it now pretty much. I mean, this whole finger quote school year, you were at home and kind of on your own and really going through what is unschooling for the first time.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Were there any new challenges in that you discovered?
Any challenges in unschooling? Yeah, I would just say, like I said in the beginning, there was just this. You know, my sister and I had definitely grown apart, as well as the four of us, my mom, my dad, my sister, and myself, while I was at school, because we were spending so much time away from home. And, you know, when we were at school, my sister and I rarely talked to each other. You know, we sort of had our own little friend groups, if you will. But when we came home, it was like we really struggled to get along. Honestly, if I'm honest, for the first few weeks, we weren't listening to each other. We didn't know what the other person was struggling with or what they needed to hear or the sort of support that they needed. But I would say those were the big struggles. But eventually, as we got back into it, we really sort of discovered our love for at home learning again. And we really started to listen to one another and interact with each other. And if somebody was having a hard day or they were perhaps being a little more slow than the rest of us, then we would learn to put our arms around their shoulder and work at their pace and take the struggles with the joy in them.
And you feel like that just happened naturally over time, or was there any deliberation about it? Did it require any special effort?
I would say there was a definite effort, especially on my part, be more selfless and really listen to my other family members. But since we had been homeschooling, it just took a little bit of remembering what that was like and all our beautiful memories homeschooling. So I would say that it happened naturally, but there was definitely some moments where we had to have conversations saying, you know, we need to be doing this for so-and-so, or we need to be not treating them this way in that whole sort of thing.
Absolutely. I got you. Now, as far as learning is concerned, obviously you and your sister are in a much better environment for real and effective learning to take place. If you can choose what you're engaging in, like, all kinds of motivation comes with that. And, you know, if that passion is there, you mentioned you listened to my show with Pam Laricchia. It was called, interestingly enough, it was called The Relationship Benefits of Unschooling.
Yes.
And one of the things on Pam's website were the three characteristics of real and effective learning: the ability to engage, the motivation that comes with choosing what you engage in, and the deep, deep thinking that follows that motivation. So you're set up to do all of those things. You've got a year ahead of you. Did you set specific goals for yourself, or how did you plan out what you were going to do as an unschooler for the first time after all these years of homeschooling and private school?
Yeah. So it was really just me sitting down with my parents and discovering what I was passionate about. And like I said, at the time it was real estate. So I devoted more time to that. I was able to, you know, travel with my uncle a little bit more in our apprenticeship and work mm-hmm. with my dad a little bit more. And then in the months following that, when I really sort of discovered again my love for history, I put so much time and effort into learning, you know, how do I start this podcast? You know, how do I market my podcast? How do I get the word out? How do I approach guests? How do I do all of these sorts of things? And, you know, besides that, I do read a lot of books for just learning, I guess. I wouldn't call it school, but, you know, that my mom and I have discussions about a lot of, you know, classic books as well as some history books that we're quite fond of. So those were the sort of goals and passions that I was going to chase after. And I did chase after when I left private school.
So did you guys talk about like outcomes? Like in school, everyone is very obsessed with outcomes.
Yes.
Doing this for the first time, how do you measure that? How do you articulate those things as far as like, you know, by, God, I hate to sound like a teacher. I was one, but by this time, this will happen. Is there any of that, or is it just more open-ended in your house?
You know, my parents are very special in the sense where they really believe in their children, right? Mm. They don't yeah. doubt their children. Even when my sister and I, you know, do have our sort of slacker moments, my parents are very quick to come in and sort of not correct us, but just say, hey, remember this dream that you told me that you're chasing after? Well, you know, remember that. And that's really been helpful. But there's never really been a doubt, really, from my parents. If I wanted to, you know, straight out of high school, I could easily be making money in the real estate realm with my dad's small business. I could start a similar type business and for one person make a considerable amount of money. But due to the success of my podcast and sort of this history community that I'm trying to build here, that is definitely something that could be monetized. And I don't want to, it's not even about like money per se, but you know, that's just what a lot of people seem to be concerned about. How are you going to support yourself when you graduate?
Well, yeah, it's about exchanging value for value. Like what you do is valuable. It definitely takes a lot of time and preparation. We're going to talk about that. I mean, I'm really interested in hearing your approach to the podcast, because how did you know how to just start a podcast and make it good? I mean, it's good right from the beginning. It's very, very professional. I have lots of compliments for you, Noah, about your show, but we'll get to that in a minute. Why don't we just back up a little bit? And since we're talking about the learning side of this, tell me how you first became interested in history. Like what sparked that for you? And then how you focused in on the Vikings. And even though we haven't mentioned it yet in our conversation, the name of your podcast and your website will definitely be in my monologue at the beginning of the show. So people will totally know what we're talking about.
Awesome.
But how you first became interested in history.
Well, you know, I've always loved history. Just ever since I was a little kid, you know, when I was like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I would always spend my summers watching BBC history documentaries. I was particularly in my younger days interested in World War II. I remember watching like a show called Greatest Tank Battles, mm-hmm. Dogfight, you know, about aces and dogfights.
So you are old enough to remember when there was history on the History Channel.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Nice. Neat.
Absolutely. But, you know, I would play these strategy games, Total War, they're called, you know, Rome, Empire, 1700s, Napoleonic computer games. And I really just devoured all things history. I would read history books. I would have conversations with my grandma about sort of the local history of Wisconsin, where I lived, you know, the French voyageurs, as they're called, explorers who sailed up and down the various rivers and came in contact with the you know, various Native American tribes and how that all panned out.
Right.
But I've always loved history, and I guess I've I can't say that I've always been particularly interested in Vikings simply because I didn't always know enough about them. But somehow I came across Norse myth, Norse mythology. That is the religion of the Vikings, Thor,
yes,
and Loki, which is awesome. And I remember reading these myths and just being so enamored by how rich the stories were and just like how weird they were too.
Bizarre. Yeah. So bizarre. We're going to talk about it. Wait, let me ask you this though, before we move on, before we get into that, cause we could get lost in that for a while and that's totally fine if we do, but what was it like when you know, you always loved history? What was it like when you hit 9th, 10th, 11th grade and a lot of the history that you're doing is through, school? What's that like?
Well, I would say that when I first went to school, it was great. My history teacher was awesome. He and I got along super well. And I think part of that is because I was one of the only students in the small class of 9 people who actually enjoyed history. So it was basically him and I having conversations about history before and after class. And I would always answer questions and that whole sort of thing. So that was super engaging. Plus, we would have like, I remember he would, and this is one of my more positive memories of school, is he would like arrange the chairs in a circle and we would actually like have historical debates. So like one day we debated the Vietnam War and whether the United States, you know, should have attempted to liberate these communist countries. And, you know, the students were like divided and it was just a super rich discussion, which was awesome.
Yeah, I asked because it was a history teacher. I wasn't expecting this to happen, and it didn't happen until I was in college, but it was a history teacher who absolutely changed the course of my life. I don't know. He has very different political ideas than I do, so I don't know how interested he would be in talking to me today and seeing the monster that he's created. You know, like, I'm definitely a Tom Woods fan, and I bet he would not be.
Yeah.
But I hated history. I hated it because of the experience that I had with it in public school. It was dreadfully boring and disconnected. And, the strongest memory that I have was going up and down the aisles in a classroom, taking turns, reading paragraphs out of a textbook. That was, you know, how we engaged with history. Or, you know, these old black and white film strips that this other teacher I had would put on and fall asleep. And I was like, if this guy isn't even interested in staying awake for this, I mean, how interesting could it be? So when I got to college and I could pick my own classes, I was majoring in communication. And one of the history professors, he had what I would call a bad reputation because I was lazy and he was said to be very, very difficult. He demanded a lot of his students. I went into his class. I was dreading it. I put it off as long as I could. And I absolutely, almost immediately, like in the first week, I fell in love with the subject. I was so moved by this guy's passion and excitement and his depth of knowledge. Even though I think some of his conclusions were wrong, I was like, oh my God, why am I realizing at 20 years old for the first time that this is interesting? And then, like, I think it was maybe 4 years later, I was a history teacher. 5 years later, I was a history teacher, right? I observed this man. I sat in his class. I took every class. I made history my minor. I took every class he had in 2.5 years, right?
Yeah.
And I think I was even taking extra classes at one point to do it.
Wow.
Yeah, it completely changed my life. But my previous – and I mean, great history teachers can come at any level of school. It just was unfortunate for me that I encountered my first one in college. So it sounds like you had an experience that was at least reinforcing – you said that was 9th grade. It was at least reinforcing your passion for history.
Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely was.
So tell me about how you focused in on the Vikings. It was the mythology that got you interested?
Yeah, it was the Norse mythology that really got me interested in it. And, like I said, I just remember being so enamored by these myths. But then I realized, you know, who are these people that actually believe this stuff? Well, it was the Vikings, and they are equally interesting, you know. And I just remember diving into a bunch of different Viking books. I think I even like took a course, an online like Great Courses course on the Vikings a few days. Looked up, you know, as much as I could find on YouTube about it, and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with these people. I fell in love with their rich history. And it's remarkable not to like geek out how you know, short a time in history, only 300 years. The Vikings were on the scene, but just such an impact they left on the world.
So the history teacher I was just mentioning in college, we barely talked about it in the Western Civ class that I took. And there were, you know, two phases of that class as well. They're in a lot of ways, they're missing from the story of history. And when they do show up, there's a myth around them, right? That they're these extremely... Now, of course, all these stories are being told from the people who interacted with them, and those interactions were rarely positive for the people on land. That's my understanding. But they're seen as these violent, filthy, deranged, like almost inhuman types of characters when they do show up. Yeah. But that's, you know, I taught a course one time called Ordinary People in Ancient Times. And, you know, I'm kind of interested in what you think life was like, or what you've learned life was like for... We shouldn't even really call them the Vikings, right? That's kind of a misnomer.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the proper term for the people that we like to call Vikings would be Norsemen, Norse women, the people of Scandinavia during the Middle Ages. And the word Viking, its origin is unknown, but basically what it means is sort of like a pirate who lurks in like a fjord, you know, a pirate who would raid merchant ships.
So they were named, they didn't call themselves that, obviously,
no,
right?
Yeah.
It's like the Sioux Indians, like Sioux means enemy, which was a name that somebody else slapped on them.
Right, absolutely.
Right.
Certainly the Vikings did go raiding. They did go... on these raids on monasteries and small villages, which were super brutal, you know. But then again, if you think about the whole of the Middle Ages, it was just a very violent time in general. So it's interesting that people only portray the Vikings in a particularly violent way. But the ordinary life of the Vikings was one of farming. They were a very agricultural people, like pretty much everybody else in the Middle Ages. Their villages and towns were centered around farmsteads, which were, of course, these, you know, just farms, houses. They would, you know, it was their lives were very similar to everyone during the Middle Ages, I would say.
So most of the raids take place along the coast of Western Europe, correct?
Yes.
Okay. They are obviously taking on a good amount of risk, right? Because there are states and kingdoms in those places that probably can outgun. It's a risky business that they're involved in, I would think. So what is the reward that they're after? How does this lifestyle develop? And obviously, it's not most Norsemen doing this, but for the small group of Norsemen who do go out and participate in these raids, what are they after?
So they were particularly fond of raiding monasteries simply because they were, of course, undefended. And the medieval Christian worldview at the time held by the monks was one of, very much trusting in God in a way that to defend these monasteries with an army of men would be blasphemous to God. If you think about the wealth of a monastery, which monasteries ironically often acted as like sort of local banks for imported goods, you're looking at chalices and cups of gold and silver, ornate jewelry, linen for religious garments, communion wine, of course, all sorts of precious metals, and which the Vikings. Oh, and then, of course, slaves. Healthy, well-fed monks that would certainly fetch a good price at the slave market. So there was all sorts of materialistic things that the Vikings were after, as well as people, because the slave trade at the time was a booming industry during the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, okay, this is total piracy. What I was going for was like, was this some means of survival for certain bands of Norsemen? Did they feel like they needed to do this to survive? It sounds like they were more after treasure.
Right. Well, the treasure certainly would have been sold. You know, silver was the sort of the – of course, there wasn't really coins in the beginning there, but it was sort of the universal currency at the time. The Vikings lived a very self-sufficient lifestyle in terms of running their farmsteads and
right, yeah.
their villages. And, you know, it's interesting to note that I think Vikings would have lived a lifestyle that would have embodied elements of both raiding and providing food for their families. So I think, you know, what made the Vikings especially powerful was their longships, which could sail right down a narrow river in France or Germany or England, as well as right up to the shoreline of a, you know, from an ocean onto a beach. And that's because of the narrow hull of the boat. So I don't know if the Vikings necessarily did it for survival as much as there was an opportunity, because the Vikings were very much traders. And that's something we often forget. So they were aware of where all these places of wealth were and where all the wealth was concentrated at the time.
So when did they first take to the sea? And yeah, I'm wondering why that happened, because it seemed like they were pretty far ahead of everybody else, right? Ahead of the Portuguese, ahead of the Spanish, ahead of the Dutch. Yeah. Like, they were out there first.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of like exploring, which that's what you're referring to, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So the Vikings discovered Iceland, of course. They discovered Greenland, and then they went ahead and discovered North America, actually, the first Europeans to do so, possibly the first people to do so, besides the Native Americans, which were living there for thousands of years before. And in terms of their exploration, you know, I just think they had the best seafaring technology at the time. Their ships were incredible. The speed and agility with which their ships could take them on is just remarkable. And it's interesting because the Vikings, before they established kingdoms, never really had to worry about like outside threats, right? They didn't have to worry about the capital of Norway being invaded, whereas right. the armies of mainland Europe were constantly warring with one another. So they had this extra time to go exploring. And once they discovered Iceland and they discovered Greenland, they then went even further west and discovered Newfoundland, which is, of course, off the coast of eastern Canada. And they built a settlement there, and they actually even encountered the Native Americans, which they referred to as Skraelings. But then they didn't last too long in North America, unfortunately. And it's probably because to send supplies over constantly would have been super expensive. So I would say that's why they were able to do the exploring that they did.
I wonder what drove them out there in the first place. And maybe that's just like a declaration. Maybe all I can do is wonder, right? They stare out at the sea. It is this complete unknown, you know, and then I start to think like how maybe the mythology factors into this.
Yeah.
The drive to do this, because it wasn't about resources. It wasn't about making friends. And it seems like the raiding was almost a byproduct of the exploration. Once they became proficient at seafaring, they were, you know, way ahead of everybody else. And, you know, the shipbuilding technology that they had, definitely, even though they were certainly, the raiders were certainly putting themselves into dangerous situation after dangerous situation, going into more established settlements that were also probably more vigilant about defending themselves from attack, even though most of the attacks at that time didn't come from the sea. Probably none of them came from the sea,
right,
when the Viking raids began.
Correct.
So that's also a huge advantage. And also, like I touched on this before, but it also shows why they are portrayed so negatively, because those people that they're raiding are the people who wind up writing most of the history that was passed along to us in the United States eventually, right? It's that legend, it's that story or that chronology that winds up being British history, that winds up being American history. So that perfectly makes sense. So, yeah, we have to leave that one unsolved, what drove them out into the sea. But let's just dig into the mythology a little bit and see if we can find some motivation or inspiration there. We mentioned this, that it's very, very bizarre. Like, even reading, like, Christian or other mainstream religion creation stories, the Vikings are far and away some of the most interesting that I've heard. Like, the first beings come from drops of water. People come from logs. Loki's son was a dog or a wolf.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah.
Like, so there's this not just interspecial, but, like, intermatter. I don't even know what you would call it. Like, absolutely. People come from logs. Beings come from water. It's fascinating. So you said this was sort of the entry point for you, the mythology. Tell me about how you started to learn about this and what you found really fascinating. And then what I ultimately want to get to, what we can talk about the things that you think are most interesting about Viking mythology. I think that even though there's probably a bunch of people in my audience who have seen the Marvel movies, that's not the whole accurate story, obviously, even though it's interesting. And the overlaps are interesting. But what struck you about it? What would you share if you were trying to spark up someone's interest in the Viking or the Norse mythology?
Oh, what I find particularly interesting about Norse mythology is just, and I know a lot of people are interested in Greek mythology. That's something that's been super popular, but Norse mythology is equally interesting in that the stories are just, like you said, so rich. Like, I just am fascinated with that part of the world to begin with, like Northern Europe and, the mountains and the Northern Lights and the just deep, dark forests, and that's where the Vikings, lived and lurked, if you will. But as far as the mythology, there's just so many, contradictions. Like you said, people coming from water. There's one Norse god named Heimdall, and he actually has, 9 mothers. Don't know how that works. Odin sacrifices himself to himself when he hangs himself from the world tree, which is the world tree Yggdrasil. And the whole universe in Norse mythology is made up of 9 worlds. And it's in these 9 worlds that all creatures dwell. And all of these 9 worlds are within the roots and branches of, like I said, the world tree Yggdrasil. And in our world is referred to as Midgard. And of course, that's where Tolkien gets Middle Earth. And then there's, of course, Asgard, where Odin and Thor and Loki live. And then there's Hel, the underworld, and Elfheim, where the elves live, and all sorts of things. But it's just stories like that, that's just... there's just so many rich stories. It's crazy. There's one story where there's these sociopathic dwarves who invite people to their homes and then drop, gigantic stones on their heads and row giants out to sea and then drown them. It's just insane.
The giants, well, first of all, that's plenty fascinating right there. I mean, and what are these dwarves up to? Why are they doing it? Or what is it an allegory for? Do you know?
No, I can't say exactly the symbolism or anything like that. There's some, scholars, it's sort of a, not as a popular view, but, that some of these stories come from, various, stories in the Bible, of course, Odin hanging himself to himself. Well, that's, a mirror to Christ's crucifixion, but I don't know if I necessarily, would agree with all that. I would like to know myself why these stories were written. Like who made this stuff up? You know what I mean?
Is there detailed study about the origin of Norse mythology and how much they might have borrowed from other Germanic peoples, or even if there was Christian influence? I'm trying to think, if we're talking about, 8th, 9th century, pretty much in the Dark Ages there, right? AD. How far is the Christian story traveling into Northern Europe? Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of interaction at that point, especially before they're, out exploring. They're not interacting with a lot of people from Christian Europe.
Absolutely. So as far as the sources of Norse mythology are concerned, basically all of it was just passed down orally generation after generation after generation. It was only written down after the Viking Age. In the 1200s, the most notable source that we have, and I'll just nerd out here, is called the Prose Edda, and that was written by a man by the name of Snorri Sturluson, and he was a nobleman in, I believe it was Iceland, and he felt that it was he felt the need to preserve the folklore and myths and legends of his ancestors. And it's interesting to note that Snorri, basically the guy who wrote all this stuff down, was a Christian. So how he goes about portraying the origin of Norse myth is interesting. I think he said that Thor, Odin, and Loki, the three gods most central to Norse myth, were descendants of Troy, and they moved north, and they were actually like real people, but they were worshipped as gods, you know, which is just so crazy to think about.
Mm. Now, what was the, to expand from there, what was the people's relationship to the gods? What, do you think it was fear-based? Was it love and admiration and respect? Or maybe their attitudes were more contextual. I know a lot of these gods are sort of earth-based or earth-related. But as we're kind of searching for some motivation for the things they did in their mythology, how did the people view the gods generally, if that's a fair question?
I think, honestly, and that's something that we don't know a whole great deal about, but I think they viewed them in many different ways. I think they were afraid of the gods. I think that, of course, they made sacrifices to their gods. And, you know, there was sort of this close relationship with the gods in a way that if a stranger came knocking at your door, that might just be Odin in his disguise visiting our world, Midgard. Or if you saw a pair of ravens, well, those could be Odin's ravens that he uses to survey and spy on the events of our world. So it's really interesting just the way that they viewed their gods. You know, of course, they had different gods that they prayed to for different reasons. There was Odin, which is the god of wisdom and poetry. So that would have been the god of the upper class, whereas Thor, the god of war and also agriculture, would have been god of sort of the everyday man, you know. And then there was fertility gods and all sorts of gods, seafaring gods. And it's just super interesting.
So, as far as the nine worlds are concerned, though, like from the stories you're telling, the gods can come from Asgard into Midgard, but are humans completely stuck in Midgard forever, or do humans ever travel to other worlds?
That's an interesting question. As far as I'm concerned, there is no story of a man or woman ever leaving Midgard while they're alive. Although, of course, when they die, they do go to two of the various nine worlds. When they die, they either go to Hel, which is the murky underworld. Nothing really of fire like the Christianity understands it, but it's just sort of this gloomy underworld presided over by Loki's daughter, the goddess Hel. Although if you were a warrior who died a honorable death in battle, you might be hand-selected by one of Odin's shield maidens, the Valkyries, and you might go to join him in Valhalla, where the great hall of Odin's hall, Valhalla in Asgard, where you would live a very interesting life indeed. You know, you would fight one another, training and battling one another. And then if you died, you would be resurrected at the end of the day, and you would have mead and you would feast with Odin, and you would be training as one of Odin's warriors for Ragnarok, which is the end of the world, the twilight of the gods, when Odin and his warriors, those who died in battle, would fight against the frost giants.
Wow.
Yeah.
The frost. So the giants play a big part in mythology, too. And the story is that Earth itself was formed from a giant that was basically like, I don't know, ripped apart and made into the earth.
Yeah, absolutely.
How does that story go?
The creation story? Yeah. So the creation of the world happens, I guess, if I was just to break it down, in the beginning, there was nothing. There was no, you know, grass, sea, heaven, earth. There was just, you know, this great abyss of darkness. And there was two realms called, if I can remember, Muspel and what was the other one? Muspel and Niflheim, yes. And from Niflheim, which is a cold, musty realm, and of course Muspel was a realm of eternal fire, and from Niflheim flows this great well of water called Vergelmir. And of course when that water met with the heat from Muspelheim, it somehow melted the ice that was in the frozen well. And once that ice was melted, out of the ice came the first living being, and that was, of course, the giant Ymir. And then the second living being was—
And they just emerged from the drops of water in the story, right? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a giant that comes first, and then some kind of animal, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, so the giant Ymir was the first living being, and then he came out of the ice, and then out of more ice came a cow, actually, called Aldumla. And Aldumla nourished herself by licking the salt stones from the remaining ice of the frozen well water, and of course Ymir nourished himself by drinking her milk. And she uncovered another being, another giant, and... Yeah, so there was a series of giants uncovered from the ice. They had children, and then they all killed the giant Ymir. And, of course, these three children are known as Odin, Vili, and Ve. Odin, the main god of Norse mythology, and his two brothers. And then they kill the giant Ymir and craft the world from his body. His brain is the clouds. His eyelashes are the great wall of mountains surrounding our world, Midgard. His bones and teeth are the rocks. You know, his hair is the grass and all this other stuff. It's just – so that's how the world was created in Norse myth, and it's so interesting to think about.
So there is some, like, fear-based relationship, right, as far as what the people's view of the gods. If, like, any time their sacrifices are required to the gods, right. It's a good – I mean, sure, there's, like, maybe appreciation and admiration in there, but it's like, this sacrifice or else, right? Like, a sacrifice isn't always the easiest or the most fun thing to do. So right. It suggests that there's some fear there, but – yeah, I think we'd really have to dig deep into the mythology to discover maybe the motivations for some of the ways that the Norsemen lived, right? I think that would probably take some time, but it's definitely – it's an interesting exploration, and I look forward to you being able to do more of it on your show. Let's talk about your approach to the podcast, just because – we could get way lost in this stuff, I think. No. Let's get a little more lost, actually. Okay. So how did the Viking Age come to an end?
The Viking Age came to an end, I would say, through the spread of Christianity. Christianity in all over Europe was really becoming the state religion at the time. You know, it was just taking Europe by storm, especially it was becoming sort of a social club as well. You know, the upper class was really embracing this new religion, which was Christianity. But up in the pagan north in Scandinavia, where the Vikings or the Norsemen, as they're more properly called, were still busy practicing their pagan rituals and worshiping their old gods. Eventually, Christianity made it that far north. And while the upper class was very quick to promote Christianity, all the kings of then Norway and Denmark and Sweden and so on, the average man or woman, you know, Christianity still influenced them, but it's interesting to know that they weren't so quick to give up their pagan beliefs. So, like, they might pray to Jesus for one thing, but then they might still wear a Thor amulet, which we can see in a lot of archaeological finds. We know that a lot of Viking men wore these necklaces, these amulets, these pendants of Thor's hammer, which was a sign of strength and that Thor was with them. So they would still wear these necklaces and they would still, you know, ask Thor to bless their crops, but yet they would still pray to Jesus for forgiveness in some things as well.
So it was the spread of Christianity, and it's also like other powers maybe starting to assert or fight back militarily in some contested areas.
Yes. Yes. Okay. It's sort of like chieftains becoming kings and kings establishing kingdoms, and eventually those kingdoms became the unified countries that we have today.
So typically, I mean, my understanding was the end of the Viking threat in Europe was the Norman conquest, right?
Yes,
which was
yes.
The 11th century?
Yeah, 1066.
Now, it's interesting to think about the age of exploration for the rest of Europe doesn't start until hundreds of years later.
Yeah.
Right? So the Vikings, I mean, maybe this all just – I don't think it lasted more than a couple centuries, right? The entire right. Viking Age, or what's considered the Viking
– right.
Because – well, actually, that's only – that's reported, right? So what's called the Viking Age is when they first show up for other people to record them.
Yeah.
So they could have been existing and even exploring – you know, back into the 6th century, the 5th century. There's no reason why that's not possible. I don't know how much debate there is about that.
Yeah, no, that's a great concept. And I guess there isn't much debate because we don't really know. You know, the great historians of the early Middle Ages and even like ancient history, so like the Roman Empire and the Greeks, they weren't too fond of barbarians, and they never bothered to send their armies or explorers that far north. And of course, the Vikings would have been considered barbarians to them, and they had enough problems with the Germanic people and the Gauls. They never made it that far north.
When is it thought that they reached Iceland?
When did they reach Iceland? I should know the year on that. I know that they reached North America in 1000. So in 1000 AD, I want to say that they reached Iceland in late 800s, early 900s, if I'm correct.
Okay. I'm just curious. I guess that would be the only way you could trace is like what artifacts can be found from certain times in the places where they were thought to be.
Yeah.
But that's fascinating. And as far as the podcast is concerned, why did you decide that was the best form for you to present this information, first of all?
Yeah. So I'd always been a podcast listener, ironically, never to history podcasts, because I wasn't a big fan of the history podcasts existing at the time. Like,
what were your favorite podcasts when you started doing this?
My favorite podcasts. I always loved business podcasts. So there's this one called the Solopreneur Hour. I love that one. I also like just like various business ones like Smart Passive Income.
Sure. That's Pat Flynn, right?
Yeah, Pat Flynn.
Yeah.
Listened to a few political ones, which I didn't necessarily agree with, but they were still interesting to like get all sides of the story. So like some of the talk radio people, like Michael Savage and sort of Mark Levin, as well as some people on the other end of the spectrum as well.
You ever listen to Carlin?
Yes, Dan Carlin. I'm a big fan of him, of his history show.
Yeah.
Hardcore history. Yeah, definitely.
And then there's another one worth checking out if you haven't heard of it yet called Professor CJ's Dangerous History.
Oh, yeah. Actually, he's in the same podcast network that I'm in.
You guys are in a podcast network? What's it called?
Yeah. Recorded History.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So your show sounds super professional. Do you like write a lot of it out ahead of time, or how do you prep to do? Let's talk about doing like a solo production, and then let's talk about how you do interviews. How do you do a show that's just you?
So in the I haven't done a solo show in quite a while. So the first,
they're lonely.
I know. I was lonely in the beginning because I hadn't got any guests to agree to come on. But they are really lonely, and frankly, I don't know if I'll do any more of them. But anyways, I would just sort of like write out a script, get various sources, write something out, try to write it in story form if possible. You know, and then just pick a topic and essentially tell it like a story. Like, I think one of them, I wrote it like imagine yourself in a time machine. And of course, it sounded a lot better than I'm saying it now. And, you know, imagine yourself traveling back to the age of the Vikings, to the time when people used horses to get around and lived in houses of thatched roofs, and in the time when kings led glorious armies into battle and so forth. But in terms of prepping for an interview, of course, I invite the person to come on my show via email. They agree to it. I schedule a time. We record the interview. As far as me prepping for it, at this point, I'm pretty knowledgeable on like what questions to ask and what questions are good questions to ask and that people are wondering. So fortunately, I don't have to do like a ton of prep for it other than just researching them and like knowing their area of expertise, I would say.
Do you see yourself like taking everything you've done and organizing it into a kind of curriculum where, you know, all areas are covered, or are you more motivated just by like what you're interested in at a given time, what you're reading? How do you approach like what the next show is going to be?
That's a good question. Let me just think about that for a moment.
Oh, believe me, if somebody asked me that question some days, I wouldn't have a great answer. You know, sometimes it is really just for me. I'll go first if you want.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time, and maybe this is actually good advice from somebody who's been doing a podcast for 9 years to somebody who's been doing a podcast for a few months.
Right.
I like the freedom of doing this. And it's so, because my show is kind of broad, even though it has to exist like within, you know, a certain range of topics, right? Yeah. But I've gone as far as saying, like, look, anything that's educational that's not taught in school can be a topic on this show. Wow. And I recently did a kind of audit of everything that was on the website to try and extract like the most valuable content we've done on the topics of why school sucks, alternative education, critical thinking, and personal development. Those are our sort of four big themes of School Sucks: one problem, three solutions. And there was a lot of stuff that just didn't fit in anywhere, you know? And I had to kind of analyze it and say, why did I do this? Why'd I do a three-part series on conspiracy theories about Hollywood? And the answer is because it was super fun. It was one of the most fun things that I ever did. And that's what I got into. That was the freedom that teaching didn't offer. There's a, like, an entertainment factor. Like, I could not have ever fit that into any kind of history curriculum in a class. And to have the opportunity to do it, it's fun for the audience, and it was really fun for me to create it. But there also, I think for me, doing this as a primary source of income, there has to be a little bit of discipline, right? And purpose in why I'm doing everything. And I need sometimes better constraints on what I'm putting into the podcast, right? The podcast could just be, look, watch an adult man have fun doing whatever he wants or pursuing whatever he's interested in at any given time. Or it can be like an authoritative resource on a series of related topics. And the latter is going to be more successful. You know what I mean? Maybe the former is more fun, but the latter is more successful. So it's trying to find a balance for me between those two. I would never want to do this if it wasn't fun. There's plenty of things that I can do and make a ton of money that are not fun, right? Yeah. This needs to be enjoyable, kind of inspirational. It has to be internally motivational, you know? And I get a lot of pleasure out of some of the simple things of doing this work. I love to do the podcast production. I wish I could do it for more people. I wish I could do it beyond my show. You know, I wish I could make more shows to do more, like putting the finishing touches on a show and picking the right music and picking the right clips and editing it together. I love that. I love taking something that's kind of like raw and messy and just fine-tuning it into something that's really, really good, because it lasts forever, you know, or it lasts as long as the internet lasts.
Right. Yeah, and I love your intro music. I'll just add that you have some of the best music out there, I would say, in terms of the whole podcasting sphere.
Oh, believe me, I'm happy to hear that, because I've spent an hour before trying to choose the right song. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
But what do you think about that?
I would definitely agree. Like, and that's great advice, because I've definitely had episodes where it was like me just having fun with, you know, what are now my friends, right? Like one episode, and we'll be doing a collaboration later. But so there's these folks called the Northern Myths Podcast, and they're like me, where they cover Norse mythology. But they do it in like such a deep way. Like they're like super into philosophy, which I like know nothing about. So like they'll like get into like they'll like literally take a Norse myth and like break it down, like using like archetypes and like their big like Jordan Peterson people and that whole thing. It's just crazy. But I recently was on vacation, so I didn't have time to get an episode out. So I reached out to them, and they guest hosted my show for me, which was so fun for me to be able to do. And I know a lot of people liked it, but I'm sure some people were like, I don't know, that's like not what we're used to. But
that episode's out already.
Yeah, the one of them like guest hosting my show. Yeah. A Norse Mythology, The Words of Odin in Disguise.
Ah, yeah. Okay. It's right on the front page of your website.
Awesome.
I found it. Yeah, I'm going to check that out. That sounds fascinating. Yeah. And I think over time you'll find that you'll want to broaden into like the historiography and the philosophical discussions about this kind of, I mean, just even the study of history, right? The study of the study of history is absolutely fascinating, especially when you get into one of these areas where there's so much darkness and so many questions. And how do you ever find answers? And how do you ever decide on, you know, the best story based on the information we have right now to put forward as a historical truth, right? That's the interesting thing about you know, the history of the Vikings is it is such a challenge compared to other periods in history, even periods that predate this, right? Because they didn't play nice with others. They didn't interact well. Their history is often written by the people they interacted with, right? Which is why, you know, the Viking history or the history of the Norsemen begins when the first raids are recorded. That's why I said they could have been at it hundreds of years, just, you know, not interacting with... I mean, obviously, there was some kind of agricultural settlements that existed in those places long, long before they ever built ships and took to the sea. But how long were they in the sea? I mean, these are just fascinating questions that other periods in history, they don't even raise because the answers are easy to find, you know?
Absolutely.
So there's a great challenge in this, and I think that will... definitely offer you lots of interesting opportunities for content in the future. And I don't know how much we can talk about the Vikings on School Sucks, but I would love to have you back to just talk about history generally, or podcasting, or just kind of finding your way in doing this as a kind of job. Those would all be great conversations. And this was really awesome. No, I'm really happy that you're doing this. I'm happy that you have the freedom to pursue this. And it's actually like really successful so far. You said you get thousands of listeners every week, right?
Yeah, definitely. Just the connections that I've made, the downloads themselves, that couple thousand downloads each week and steadily growing even after 2 months. Just me guesting on a lot of other notable podcasts, writing articles. It's just crazy, joining a network, which I'll be, able to monetize through them pretty quickly because that's how it works. So, yeah,
absolutely. Well, that's very cool. And like I said, people will know the website and the name of the podcast right from the beginning of the show, but can you give it again here at the end?
Yeah, so the podcast is The History of Vikings. You can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts, of course, and my website is thehistoryofvikings.com.
Awesome. Noah, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Brett. It's been an absolute delight to have this conversation with you, and just keep doing what you're doing. I love what you've created through School Sucks. It's been such an inspiration to me. So thank you so much for all of your hard work doing what you do.
My pleasure. I definitely appreciate you saying that.